It's a very nice village, but it's a bit scattered. It's a bit scattered. Awfully scattered. It's a scattered community.
Well, hello, everyone. Oh, hold on. Oh, I forgot to. All right. Hello, everyone. Welcome. This is another special stream. It's a special stream because it's time once again for Dark Lord Watch. Our Lord and Master, Tony Blair, is once again on the scene. And I thought, well, who better than to join me on this? I usually do them solo, but I thought if Scrump and Evelyn are around, they should come on as well as fellow Blair enjoyers.
Unlimited power.
Yes. Hallelujah, hallelujah, praise be and amen. The Dark Lord has come before us.
Yes.
So before we get going, today, ladies and gentlemen, is the last, L-A-S-T, last day that the promo code MELLOW will work on Academic Agency. Everything must go. Every last coupon must be spent. Once they're gone, they're gone. Don't know when that will happen, but today is your last day. Try it tomorrow. It won't work. And the next sale won't be until whenever SummerSlam usually is. It's sometime in August, so it's your last chance to get money off courses until August. And then the next chance after that will be Christmas, probably. So, you know. No. Hold on a minute. Halloween, then Christmas. Whenever Steam do their sale. I follow Steam, you know. I find it. It's a good model to follow the Steam sale. So there we go. Scrump and Evelyn, where can people find you? And have you got anything you'd like to promote?
People cannot find us anywhere, for we are hidden in esoteric, and only those who truly, truly seek us out may find us. However, we will be doing a stream tomorrow with Hat, talking about the subject of smoking.
So. Yes, you can find us on the Scrump Monkey YouTube channel. You can just type in Scrump Monkey, it'll come up, because nothing else is called that, and it's kind of a legacy name on my part. We also do the anti-politics Substack. I recently put out a big piece there called The Sea of Worry that people seem to enjoy. And I actually have some crossover topics with some of this as well, mostly because of the big consensus soup that's being put out there, but we'll get to all that. But yeah, there's the anti-politics Substack. You can always join our Telegram. I have a Discord that's more of a legacy Discord though these days because it got banned a couple of times, but we're all over the place. Generally, if you go to the YouTube, you can find most of our stuff from there though.
Yes, there is enough people who are obviously curious about it that when you start typing Scrump into like the YouTube thing, one of the autocompletes is Scrump and Evelyn, or Scrump Monkey Evelyn, all as one word. People are obviously finding it somehow.
Fair enough.
Just before, I don't want to get into rank punditry, but you said you're going to talk about smoking. By the way, I am not buying that Humidor chat. I am using a Tupperdor, which only costs £20, as opposed to the £900 walking kind of cabinet Humidor I was eyeing up. But sometimes in life, you have to sacrifice and not buy the big shiny thing, and this was one such occasion. But I did notice that the government, the glorious Tory government, has banned smoking generationally, and I think it's if you're born anyone younger than being born in 2009, is that right?
Yes,
I think so. Yeah,
never be allowed to smoke.
It's one of those weird Five Eyes laws, as I call them.
Yes.
Basically, apart from the US, which is the seat of empire, an exception, Britain, New Zealand, Australia, and Canada all end up within a roughly 10-year span having exactly the same legal framework, which is interesting. But
I mean, it's a completely stupid and unworkable law because...
Oh, yes, of course.
The man born in 2008 as a 70-year-old will be, you know, sneaking ciggies to the 69-year-old in, like, 50 years' time. I mean, it's just fucking stupid.
As if we haven't had a bustling industry of selling rolling tobacco to 15-year-olds in this country anyway.
I was chilling out in a cigar lounge yesterday, by the way, and I was having a whale of a time smoking a Sancho Panza Bellicoso, and then... A rather rotund Palestinian man came down and started talking. So the second hour that I was there, I was basically just hearing like horror stories of what wankers the Israelis are for like a whole hour. But he was very, very cigar chomping, this Palestinian chap. But I do recommend chilling out in cigar lounges if you can find one.
I prefer to engage with cigar lounges that have a stronger solidarity with the nation of Israel.
All right, so why are we gathered here for this special stream? It's actually two special streams in 2 weeks. I don't want to make it a weekly habit, but things keep on cropping up, and I like to be agile, as you know, being someone on the bleeding edge of online commentary, like a kind of political David Bowie. You guys can be Velvet Underground if you'd like.
Oh, that's very kind of you.
Yes,
Lou Reed and Iggy Pop or something like that.
We can be the bleeding edge of the bleeding edge.
Evelyn, you can be Transformer.
You bastard.
And Scrub can be what's that Iggy Pop album? Raw Power. You can be Iggy Pop. All right. So
the autists. For the musician, yeah.
The Sperg.
Not many people listened to us, but everyone who heard us went away and had their own Sperg. So
yeah. Yeah, but by the time you get down to some of the more mainstream acts, they've kind of watered it down, and it's like kind of
this is how like an indie artist feels. You see what you've been writing a year later, more watered down on something that's a lot more commercial. And you think, it's
not mentioning names or anything, but there's like kind of Wizard and Mud and bloody Roxy Music are out there, you know.
They've uncrunched our grooves. Yeah, how could they?
Various gradients. But there's one guy with a Substack with like 5 followers saying like, yeah, you're saying you're the Bowie and the Lou Reed, but I'm what's that guy's name? The Incredible Space Cowboy or whatever it was they were stealing stuff from in the mid-60s. So anyway. Yeah, you should check it out. I took a trip on my incredible spaceship. I noticed, well, I couldn't help but notice because of the amount of people tagging me on Twitter, that the Dark Lord has been given a glossy kind of like, you know, multiple page spread Sunday Times magazine. In fact, if you bought the Sunday Times this week, the pullout magazine was basically dedicated to Blair.
The cover of it is pure. Yeah. Like he must have workshopped this with all of this with them intensely, because it feels less like an interview and more like a press pack.
This is months of work, I presume.
I mean,
they didn't just come up with this idea to do like a full spread on them and almost advertise this as if it's like some sort of pre-made sort of package. I mean, one of the best ones we covered at one point was one of the large insurance DEI climate change finance body sort of conglomerates that had its own dedicated vertical in The Economist. This is like the Tony Blair vertical in the Sunday Times.
You can just buy column space if you have enough money. So
now this is a bizarre thing I've noticed in my years of Dark Lord watching. I mean, first of all, this is not the first time the Sunday Times has just given Tone unlimited space to just say what a great guy you are. I mean, it's basically like the Sunday Times presents Tony Blair and basically blowjobs him for pages upon pages. But this has happened before. This work here was Tony Blair on ambition, housework, and still living like a prime minister. This was another one they did back in after he was the prime minister. Here was another one. He's back and he's busy running the world. Here's another one. Still got it. I mean, and what I love about the production values on these. This is not just like it's almost like he's gone for a Vogue shot or
yes. the four you had as the thumbnail is almost like, you know, so these pictures, it's like an actor's range. It's like his actor's range.
I was more thinking of the and this may be slightly more a reference attuned to my own liking, but Luke Littler on Forbes. Some similar vibes to this.
It does. It's a bit incongruous, but they are trying to go for the production value aspect. And to be fair, with the content and the production values, to the layman, it does kind of work. I think this is, for people who consume news, relatively effective. Yeah, it's quite a safe approach and quite a good approach.
I like the lineup of the four. It's like, what Blair are you today? I think I'm number four today. What one do you think you are?
Oh, I'm definitely number two. I'm definitely thinking Blair. You know, I'm not smiling. I'm looking at with his hand, with his thumbs in his waistband, going, oh you, Gordon Brown, your theory
it's
self.
It's like the Spice Girls where you've got to pick, you know, I'm posh and you're scary. And
yeah.
I've noticed, by the way, that, I mean, there is a selection of Blair-friendly media, of which Sunday Times, or the Times in general, but especially the Sunday Times magazine, is one. GQ is another one. And do you remember that kind of very entertaining Blair versus Alistair Campbell interview? That was produced by GQ, who are constantly giving Tony Blair awards. Like, for example, they gave him the GQ Man of the Year. They gave him Philanthropist of the Year, and they constantly run kind of puff pieces for Blair. And you know that famous shot of Blair doing the power stance? That is from another one of those. That was from a GQ photo shoot, which was done like as if he was a kind of supermodel or something.
I have to admit, I do like the comment that's just gone past in chat about someone pointing out, well, you know, he's just a normal guy who wears jeans. It's just like, when is Tony Blair ever publicly appeared anywhere in a pair of jeans and a blazer?
Never.
But here he is looking all sort of fashionable and, as you say, very GQ.
He's like Mark Zuckerberg if he had a better kind of makeup and props and appearance department. He's a globalist. He looks like he might eat the human food, you know? He just about managed to get by with that, whilst also being Tony Blair. And it's so funny that this can just happen. He's somebody who, like, 10 years ago was considered almost like radioactive in domestic British politics. And now he's like a puff piece cannon, and he's somebody who's settled back into the background noise of British politics, almost uncontroversially. In fact, they have to try and make him more controversial here.
Well, I think that's part of his whole trick, and I'm sure it's one of the things we'll discuss as we get into more sort of detail about it, but he is just one of the best, I think, globally, at recognising where he thinks politics is going to go and placing himself there years in advance, knowing farewell that everyone's going to catch up with him. And at the end of the day, he gets to look like the clever guy.
He tends to pick message and then stick with it for a very long time.
Mm.
I don't know if you guys noticed this week, I'm sure you have, that Keir Starmer is saying that Labour is now the patriotic party. They're going to reclaim the English flag on St. George's Day. And what is so interesting, if you read, you know, the new Labour doublespeak, is just how they're constantly playing both sides at the same time. So you could imagine Baz reading that and thinking, yeah, the Tories have gone woke. You know, I appreciate Keir Starmer, you know, getting out the St. George's flag. But if you read it, it's very subtly left-coded as well.
Of course. It's political switcheroo that's been going on. I mean, I don't know, not to toot our own horn, but we did literally do a stream about this about nearly, must be going on 3 years ago now, maybe two.
Not quite, but two and a half.
Okay, about 2.5 years ago. Literally just called the UK political switcheroo about the fact that this manoeuvre was being done even then. It's been done, I wouldn't say slowly, because it's been done kind of slightly jerkily, but they really did put the biometrics immigration stuff out there in like 2022, in the early 2022, and they've stuck with that rather solidly. And this idea of blue-coded Labour, but also kind of still new Labour, is very much the direction they've headed on ever since Starmer got in. They kind of did it day one, and it became very obvious almost day one that this would be the tact. But as I keep reminding people, Labour knows that racial politics exist. They know that the Conservative Party is a white party helmed by a non-white person. and they are a non-white grassroots party helmed at a national level for the national party by a visible white leader. And that is deliberate. I know people kind of roll their eyes and think most people don't think in those terms anymore and the propaganda is too much, but it isn't. People do vote with their feet and what color their feet are. And that does still make a difference.
Can I just say as well, sorry to carry on with our tortured analogies of, Bowie, Lou Reed, and Iggy Pop, but one of the acts downstream from us, so in my opinion, is Unheard. Who is it for? A question you've answered before, but have a look. They've got in there already. Look. This is like Slay doing a cover version of All the Young Dude or something. this was Unheard yesterday. They got in there. Tony Blair, autocracies are fine with smart leaders.
They probably got press Tony, package.
You don't make it easy for the Blairite defense. So you can see that they have spotted a kind of opportunity in this little gray area where people are starting to question democratic values and so on. And so there's a kind of weird, elite theory build appreciation of Blair that they're actually through the back door using to appeal to the unheard reader. You notice this?
Yes. Well, I took it as no surprise whatsoever that sort of Musk and that kind of sphere seem to be placing themselves closer and closer to the likes of Blair, who obviously recognizes that he's over and above ideology. He's over and above both old and new Labour values, which he'll still appeal to, but knowing fair well that that's the set dressing for what he does, he's probably very happy to sidle up next to these, the PayPal mafia or whatever you want to call them. I think those are his people. Not explicitly, but I could see them working together well.
If you were to say, who is Tone aligned with? Is it big tobacco? Clearly not. Is it big oil? No. Is it big tech? Yes.
Yes.
I mean, basically, those are his patrons. It's been, it's not just Bill Gates, it's the dude at Oracle, Larry
Ellison.
Yeah. I mean, Gates and Ellison are the two biggest Tone backers. Starting to think it may have been a mistake to allow him a copy of Populist Illusion because he is starting to sound more like us. But in a way, he's just reading stuff he already taught us in the first place. So let us have a look at the actual article, if we may. And I can't wait until his book comes out, by the way. That's going to be so... You're going to get all these kind of online reading lists, and it's going to be Machiavelli's The Prince, Tony Blair's New Manual. I'm just going to come. But anyway, let's have a look at this interview by Oliver Shaw. Clearly, this has had some production values behind it, like we said. The former prime minister has reinvented himself as a secret global influencer. And the Tony Blair Institute's 800 staff are now helping to run almost 40 countries. If Labour wins, will he be pulling the strings? So, I don't know how secret it is anymore, but, go on.
That's the again, they're almost trying to conspiracy jack at him. They're trying to Klaus Schwab him. They're trying to make him more cool by making him look like essentially a globalist supervillain. And it's because as things start to degrade, the people who look like they're in power and look like they're in charge will be more looked to. I think really we do a lot of his work for him as well. And I think the influence of the Tony Blair Institute and Tony Blair itself is greatly overstated. A lot of it is image. A lot of it is boilerplate advice. A lot of it is them trying to explain on fag packets to corrupt warlord ministers what crops are. Basically, a lot of the Tony Blair Institute actually doesn't do very much in these countries. But what it does is it looks in charge. And if you look in charge for long enough, and if you look in charge, look like you're in charge in enough places, people will treat you like you're in charge.
Yeah, it's prestige.
Yes.
If you're Tony Blair's mate and you're, running some third world tin pot country where the only reason you stay afloat as a government is the fact that institutes like the Tony Blair Institute or any other big organization like that does lots of big data stuff for you, so you can keep an eye on everyone.
It sounds like a truism, but in terms of global governance, the levers of power lead nowhere. It's an exercise in, if you look like you're in charge and people believe you are in charge, you are in charge. And Tony Blair very much understands that. This is very much an exercise of saying, I am the moderate, I am the neutral, I am the pragmatist, I am in charge.
He has two advantages, and I should have really explained, like, is it, over my years of studying, I think I've worked out exactly what it is the tone does. So the first advantage he has is that in the absence of any plans, the one person who's got a plan has absolute advantage, right? Cool. This is what happened during COVID. Every government was like, oh, shit, what do we do now? And up rocks Tone and says, well, just so happens, we've got a plan. It's the one that my mate Bill Gates came out with. Here you go. And he basically sells that into the government. But his day-to-day, his bread and butter, is much more mundane than this. It's basically convincing every government to turn to technological and technocratic solutions that have been devised by his mates in big tech. That's basically what it is. If you actually drill down into what it is he's selling, yeah, it is these off-the-shelf solutions that ticks that are, you know, in the language of the WEF, it's private public partnerships. Yes. In lay terms, it's let Apple or Microsoft build you a bridge.
Off the big one's Facebook. Nobody talks about it, but the biggest portal to the internet in the so-called third world is something called Free Basics by Facebook. And if it becomes used for purposes the US government doesn't approve of, it is switched off immediately, like in what is it? We have to call it now Myanmar, or as they say in proper money, Burma.
Well, one thing I picked out specifically in this interview, and it reminded me of something we covered a while ago, you know, 2004, 2005, people in the London School of Economics are writing papers calling Tony Blair's idea for digital ID tyranny, and it's not going to work with the market, and it's not going to fit into British society. And then come 2022, 2023, the LSE has completely changed its mind and has decided that consultations on digital ID is a fundamental thing to get the economy moving, which is exactly what Blair said. And even in this article specifically, there's the example of Nick Clegg, who spent supposedly years as a Lib Dem member rallying against Tony Blair's plans for first physical plastic IDs, then digital IDs. Where is Nick Clegg now? He's an ambassador for the Meta Group.
Well, you see, this is the thing, that Blair's ultimate plan, or the plan that he is helping to implement all around the world, is, do you remember in one of the Batman Nolan films, The Dark Knight, I think it was, or The Dark Knight Returns, there's Batman figures out a way to track everybody's mobile phone. And there's that massive grid. And Morgan Freeman's there saying, oh, I don't know, man.
You shouldn't do that.
You shouldn't do that. And he's like, yeah, I'll just do it this one time. Basically, they want to create something that looks like that on a global scale. This is why they're trying to ban TikTok everywhere, because TikTok is not under the purview of that. Whereas I feel that all of the... Any Western-owned companies, including Elon Musk's Twitter, by the way, are under that purview, right? They are under the managerial regime of this vision that people like Blair are trying to build. And if you think about Africa and various other places around the world, South America, some parts of the Middle East, as being... bits of the map that could be flipped red and blue, like during the Cold War. Okay, what Blair is engaged in all around the world is trying to get the infrastructure of each of those countries hooked up to the Western aligned grid, not the China aligned grid. And once you understand this, you'll understand, like, well, when the Niger government was toppled and the French were kicked out, also, the Tony Blair Institute was kicked out. And what that really meant was, is that those countries in the Sahel, which is something that we were onto a lot before everyone else, because we obsessively watched Blair, of course. But, you know, do you remember he was talking about the Sahel like 3 years ago or something?
Yes, he was.
What really happened there is that they were able to flip the infrastructure, Russia and China were, to them, of the Sahel, to that grid, not to the grid that Blair is trying to build. Would you agree with that basic analysis? That's what I was
kind of. My analysis would be that the Tony Blair Institute gets the wind put up it by any hint of hard power. And the moment Russia basically went, by the way, we'll give you a bunch of hard-hitting Wagner people to settle your civil war, mm-hmm. I don't think any amount of internet infrastructure can really compete with that. And I think that is the big problem with a lot of this global governance, semi-soft power, technological solution stuff, is that if you get enough people with big rocks, it all gets smashed. And right, it doesn't really have any physical permanence, apart from protection from, obviously, the global American empire. But if what happened in the Sahel can happen in other places where there's a bluff, but it's not called, and these places can almost seed, as it were, from this grid, then they're going to have increasing problems.
But, you know, this is the other side of the Tone ledger, right? Because he's one of the few people who straddles both the kind of what I call the techno-globalist sphere, which is all this stuff we're talking about, and is basically the hardest core neocon imaginable, right?
Oh, yes.
There's not a war the Tone isn't up for. There's not a bombing he hasn't supported. He's, you know, he's up for the Ukraine war. He was up for, I mean, he was giving interviews in 2009 about the need to go into Iran. He was against Assad, you know. So Blair, who understands exactly what you just said, he's got a foot in, or a seat at, you could say, the what's that Foreign Relations Council called in America? Council of Foreign Relations.
Foreign Relations.
Yeah. So he basically triages those three things, right? The Western soft power through big tech, essentially, and all this infrastructure stuff we're talking about, but at the same time trying to use American power as a guarantor of those kind of imperial soft power projects.
I think you could explain quite at least a large portion of it by going back to a phrase I don't think gets used anymore: nation building. It's all modern nation building.
Yeah.
Insofar as the fact that Blair and the people that work under him, their vision of a nation is one that's got a centralized big data bureaucracy that operates on the systems that their friends sell on. And this is all backed up in some way, shape, or form by the notion that the American government will turn up and flatten anyone who doesn't allow that nation building to carry on. And if that means flattening some faction of people called the Taliban, or whether it's people in Thailand, wherever it is, that'll happen first. And then, lo and behold, because you've flattened them and you've killed millions of people, there's even more opportunities for nation building. There's a bigger problem to solve.
Yes, there is.
You also have the absurd, I mean, especially in the case of Africa, where Blair has done a lot of stuff, you've got the absurd juxtaposition of, you know, Blair making deals with all these kind of tin pot governments to build massive blade centers and like data storage solutions, where most of the population like don't have running water and are still walking to the well with buckets on their heads, like literally. But we're giving you the latest 5G technology, you know, world class
kind of
vaccines and educational facilities and women's rights, but they haven't even. It's like, you know, in their conception, the Industrial Revolution, the second, now we're on the fourth one. They're trying to speed run to the fourth one when they haven't done stages one, two, and three in many cases.
I can tell you their mindset, because we've talked, I believe I kind of spoke to you a little bit as well about the off-the-shelf solutions that these NGOs come up with, that their big advantage is that, yes, that they do just have these canned solutions, that and they all talk to each other, they all have the canned solution to offer, so they'll all interlock. And really what they do is they go into these countries and they gain control by offering them flat pack managerial governments. They come in and they say, look, We'll give you Facebook. We'll give you this. We'll give you, you know, the equivalent of our DBLA system. We'll give you the equivalent of our semi-social credit system. We'll give you the equivalent of our, you know, other information systems. And what we'll do is we'll basically flat pack a basic managerial government into your third world shithole. And we will basically, it'll be kind of a turnkey system. You'll run it, but effectively we'll have the maintenance contract for your country.
Yes.
And we'll be in control, because if anything goes wrong with it, you have to turn to us and go, excuse me, Mr. Blair, would you fix my managerial machine, please? And he turns around and goes, oh, don't worry, the gophers will do it. And then his little information gophers will come out, and they'll service Guyana or whatever the hell they're setting up these little franchises. And that's really how they think of it. They think that governance can be transplanted with the economic unit people they think of. They literally think that you can take a almost like a crayon drawing of British society, distill it down to a technical package, and sell it to a third world country, and they'll be able to one, become a vassal state, and two, be able to become a successful vassal state. But as we've seen with a lot of the Arab Spring stuff, that just doesn't happen.
Yeah, I was gonna add
sorry Evelyn, let me give a really good example of exactly what Scrump is talking about, because one of the most corrupt, like just like laughably corrupt regimes on earth at the moment is in Egypt, okay, where they're literally spending billions upon billions of dollars, hundreds of billions of dollars, on building a new capital, a new Cairo. There's a very good video on this by Real Life Law, where he goes into the kind of staggering plans of the Egyptian government. They've built a lot of it already. It's absolutely massive. And the reason they're building this new city in Cairo is because, you know, they've had a lot of revolutions in Egypt. One of the reasons they've had a lot of revolutions in Egypt is because the government centers are right in the middle of the city. So it's easy for people to get to. So if you build this new city in the desert and you don't build good transport links and don't provide public transport to there, you know, you're not going to get millions of people, you know, marching across the desert to get to this new city. So it's harder to overthrow them. But to Scrump's point, I didn't even know this until he started talking. I just had a funny feeling. Who was there? There he is. Look. I mean, you can play that game. Think of a corrupt country, type in Blair, and there he is on the scene, helping LCC get up and running. And now, you know, it's Tony Blair embodies corruption and war. He must be sacked. So there we go. And that CC government, if I'm not mistaken, is still going. Anyway, Evelyn, sorry, I cut you off.
Well, what I was going to add was, I think there's another interesting dynamic to this sort of setting up governments in foreign countries as well. You know, we, at least in Britain, in the minds of most people, there is this sort of civics class idea that all the different arms of government are operated by different people with different intentions, and that each one is in some way at odds with another element, so that there is accountability and that the bureaucracy doesn't just move as one big mass that all agrees on a single issue. But when Blair turns up, you know, as a representative of the TBI and all these technocratic sort of leaders, and says to a third world country, well, here's all your government, all in one piece, all in one faction, all run by the same people, operating off the same playbook, that illusion of this sort of conflict within government completely disappears. And I do wonder if, to some extent, because it's very clear, especially mentioned in that Times interview, that Blair isn't happy with how discordant elements of the British state are within themselves. And that he could probably, and probably is, I would imagine, using the results they've got from selling single big package governments to third world countries to work out how to sell people in Western countries the idea that their government isn't this organic entity with all its little different arms and each one holds another to account. That they'll find some sort of futuristic technological way of selling a new narrative where, well, we've got rid of all that old nonsense with bureaucracy. Now AI deals with the disputes, completely neglecting the fact that this whole idea of the government not being a monolith gets completely pushed to the wayside as that gets implemented.
Yeah, and I wonder if he ultimately wants to get rid of democracy altogether. But,
I think he says as much in that Times piece. Well, he's saying...
Why don't we read through it? Let's read through it.
Yeah, let's read through it.
Interestingly, it starts like this. Enoch Powell said... So here we get a non-critical Enoch Powell quote, by the way. Interesting. Enoch Powell said that all political lives end in failure. In fact, almost all prime ministerial lives end in corporate sinecures. Before she retreated into the solitude of classical music and songs of praise, Margaret Thatcher was a consultant to the cigarette maker Philip Morris and the hedge fund Tiger Management. John Major made discreet millions chairing the European business of the US private equity firm Carlyle, a prolific defense investor, and served as a senior advisor to the investment bank Credit Suisse. Between writing books and doing charity work in Fife, Gordon Brown helps the bond investment giant PIMCO and the Swiss private equity firm Partners Group. And as Foreign Secretary in waiting, David Cameron had his misadventures with the scandal hit finance provider Greenshill and the call center software developer Affinity. So just a nice bit of iron law of oligarchy stuff to start us off. But on an unassuming street in Fitzrovia, sandwiched between a high-end gym and a nail salon, sits the locus of a Downing Street afterlife that defies easy description and far exceeds any of these in the scale of its ambition. I always say to people, we're not an NGO, we're not a government department, and we're not a charity, says Sir Tony Blair in that eminently reasonable, slightly effeminate diction that somehow flutters free of the heavy baggage that still surrounds his time in office. We're a not-for-profit, which means that any of the profits go back into this institution, but we expect to, and then it's cut off. And characteristically, Labour's only winner of three consecutive elections hesitates. Catherine Rimmer, formerly his number 10 chief of staff and now his chief executive, finishes the sentence for him to deliver. It took almost a decade after his retirement as prime minister for Blair to shape this particular peculiar beast. In 2016, he folded his various foundations and commercial activities, which had been channeled through companies with names that seemed to belong on brass plates in the Cayman Islands, Fire Rush Ventures and Windrush Ventures, into a single organization, the Tony Blair Institute for Global Change. The TBI, as it is known, is now active in almost 40 countries with more than 800 staff and revenues that approached $140 million last year. It had big outposts in Abu Dhabi, Nairobi and Singapore, with another planned in Washington. From its London headquarters, Blair oversees an unofficial global government that gets involved in everything from guiding Saudi Arabia's crown prince on modernization to telling the UK how it should harness the promise of artificial intelligence.
Isn't it interesting that they just openly say, well, of course, he's involved in a secret, shadowy global government?
Yeah, this is them advertising the fact that he is trying to pitch himself as the head of a global government. Because it's always been my belief that he will gobble up the WEF when Klaus Schwab kicks it.
Oh, yes.
Because they basically said as much, that Klaus Schwab's a weirdo, he has no air, he has shit people around him. There was a Guardian article that basically just said that. And really, that the only person who they could look to, it was kind of implied, was Tony Blair.
Yes. Well, I mean, what else is he being framed at as, if not, you know, a sort of plucky leader of an organized minority that sees itself as above and beyond both governments and multinational corporations and charities? They want to be something entirely new, which of course they will take full sort of responsibility to define. So therefore they're doing something that no one understands, but they're still getting power as they do it. It's sort of like an arcana or a secret. They won't tell anyone what it is, but they just know it does things.
Look at this next paragraph. His stardust has probably been a factor in its ability to hire the likes of General Sir Nick Carter, former chief of the defence staff, and Sir Patrick Vallance, the former chief scientific advisor. Yeah, it was his stardust. Yeah, stardust. That's what happens, is that people are just kind of, they glaze over and they kind of come over all funny because Blair's name is at the top of the bill. Do you believe that, or do you think that they know, they understand that this is a true power center, and that's how you get people like this? And who was that? You know, the Finnish prime minister and people like that going to work there, because they understand that it's probably a promotion from their old jobs to work here.
Yes, it is very. If you strike me down, I will become more powerful than you can ever imagine. Yes, he is like weird Force Ghost Blair. he was voted out of office and he just became more powerful, which I think is a great example to people. But
hold on, he was never voted out of office. He went out on top. Don't forget.
You're right. You're right. He never was voted. He left office of his own accord, but he graduated like an idol.
I was going to say they try and pull a sort of like, oh well, after a long winded fight, he succumbed to Gordon Brown in 2007. No, not really. He basically got bored of being prime minister, realized that the position had so many limitations that he was better basically being a supervillain.
Yes.
Than try to be prime minister.
I actually got very interested in that question and went to see what the time was between him leaving office and starting to work with Gates and so on. And I believe it was less than 24 hours at midnight. It was like the first payment came in and then it starts. I covered that on a previous stream. It's
yes,
like pretty much straight away, 2007. Day one, he started. So,
but that to me appears to be sort of Blair and Co's playbook. You know, they turned up in 1997, not what just with a manifesto and some plans and some catchphrases, but they came in with the prototype of the NGO networks that we're only too familiar with now.
Yes, they did. They came in with a public-private partnership ready-made. It's in that book. It's in Blair's book. He's talking about the public-private partnership. He's talking about the Blair Institute, effectively, in that book. Yeah. This has been their project the entire time. The first thing they do is they come in with a bunch of effectively proto-global backing, and they shank the old remnants of the Labour Party. They basically turn it into what it became with New Labour. And then they kind of did this weird struggle session with their base, with Jeremy Corbyn saying, no, you actually can't just be a socialist party, you idiots. And it's one of the greatest examples, I think, of ritual humiliation is what was done to the Corbynites.
Well, yeah.
It was quite beautiful in its way.
Well, it comes back to what A's point was at the top of the show. If you're the man with the plan and no one else has got a plan, you instantly look legitimate and respectable in the front of everyone else who doesn't. And this has always been Blair's playbook.
This is what, I hate to say it, this is what we do. We try and exist in the political future. We try at least to look like we know what's about to happen even when we don't.
Well, that's what I was going to go on to say. The whole lesson from studying Tony Blair is that you should think like him. Think what's going to happen in 15, 20 years' time, not what's going to happen on fucking Twitter next week.
Well, the other thing that he did while he was in office, which is part of the kind of the playbook of these people, is he set up all sorts of quasi-permanent institutions and stuffed them with his minions. You know, I mean, we all know about the Supreme Court, but they're, you know, Ofcom and all of these kind
of... The Child Poverty Commission.
You know, all of these
which
new
things.
Which
was sassoned by a Mr. Matt Goodwin, I believe. But anyway.
All of these kind of new institutions that are set up basically then become their own little factories, their automatic self-generation units for new Blairites, which is essential if you have read your Louis Althusser ideology and the ideological state apparatus. Because, you know, so they... And the other thing that happened while we're on this topic is that, of course, he could count on the Tory party, having been captured by David Cameron, not to shut down any of those Blair generation units. Because, you know, competent opposition would have immediately shut all those down day one in 2010, but they didn't do it. So you couldn't get two more experienced people in their field, Blair says mildly, of the recent double poaching. We've got governments around the world that are worried about security or how to deal with science and technology. We've got two people we can offer them who've gone and done it. Can you imagine Patrick Vallance, the utter shit show that was COVID in this country, and he just gets promoted up to advise governments around the world on how to do it now? If it was Boris Johnson who, as a child, wanted to be world king, but among Britain's swelling ranks of ex-prime ministers, it is Blair who has come the closest to seizing that crown. The TBI's overarching vision is the one Blair has been honing ever since he overtook Gordon Brown to claim the leadership after the death of John Smith almost 30 years ago. That what wearied electorates really want and need is not ideology, but yes, you guessed it, apolitical delivery.
The neutral position. Neutral, natural, technical government.
They don't even want the BS. They just want the therefore I rule.
Yes.
Yeah, they don't even want BS, therefore I rule. I like that. Clasping at a black coffee on the light and bright second floor of his office, the TBI's executive chairman declares that Western democracy has lost its sense of mission. Can you imagine these Sith-like offices where these dark figures are just making these pronouncements? What brings good people into any organization, including government, is if they think there's a plan, right? He says, what's happened is that people have become, in my view, misguidedly pessimistic about what we can do and how we can alter the problems that we've got. It is possible to make huge and deep-seated reform today in public services, in government itself. The productivity of the economy could improve dramatically as a result of the application of technology. So it's a really exciting world, but what I find quite interesting when I talk to people in politics is that they're a little depressed about the future. They think if you're in government, there's just a limit to what you can do. Maybe you can squeeze a bit more of tax and spending here or a bit less of it there. There's no mission. And I'm saying there is a huge mission. We are undergoing this technology revolution. It's going to accelerate. And that's the real world. Politicians often look at me a bit curiously and think, well, maybe he's been too long out of the front line of politics. And I just say to them, no, technology is going to change everything. And I quoted that back on Twitter and said, is he trying to tell us he's going to clone himself like Palpatine? Because how is technology the answer to him being in out of frontline politics for too long? I mean, anyway, yeah, come in.
Oh, no, I was going to say, I have a feeling a lot of people would read that, assume this is like a basic positive negative vision sort of dichotomy.
Yeah.
And then just presume, well, people like Blair because he says good things will happen. I think that's too simplistic. I think in those two paragraphs, the main thing he's actually appealing to is struggle.
He's appealing to the idea of almost himself as a great man. He's talking about government as being unimaginative, as lacking not the resources, but the will and the imagination to make change. But, he is talking about his perception of reality being higher than other people's, basically, and having greater vision. And the idea that really managerialism in his mind has run out of vision. But managerialism has no vision. It believes in nothing. It's a bizarre double thing. He's the closest facsimile of a great man that managerialism can produce. So he does great things and expends great resources and centralizes great power in service of, well, really nothing. There is, apart from the expansion of the Tony Blair Institute and the personal power of Tony Blair and the expansion of technocratic government, there's no vision here. There is no actual vision at all. This actually just says nothing.
I'm sorry, but there is a vision.
Yeah.
The vision is struggle. I mean, what does he always do? I remember actually distinctly, we were looking at one point the Future of Britain event that Tony Blair Institute hosted.
Yes.
And they had Starmer there, and they did what I feel to be quite a revealing little 20-minute back and forth with Starmer and Blair. And the whole discussion they had was, well, we've had to put in so much hard work. It's been such a struggle to reorientate the Labour Party around our new principles. And it's because of that struggle we'll make something out of it. He always seems to me like someone who isn't appealing to a utopia, but just the actual very notion of hard work. As he's saying here, the technological change isn't just going to happen. We've got to go out there and strive for it.
This is another. I wrote an article once called "The Kind of Schmittian Paradox of Blair," where he's got this sense of divine mission, right, which is inevitably going to happen. But then he says, it's not going to happen unless we make it happen, but it's going to happen. So he always makes these two points. It's like, it's going to happen whether we like it or not, and we have to get on that steam train, but also it might not happen, and therefore we have to make it happen, which I've never quite understood how he can make both of those arguments at the same time, but he does.
I mean, to be fair, a lot of the arguments around Marxism and the collapsing of capitalism went very, very similar, and a lot of people seem to be convinced by those.
It's kind of, yeah, but it's like the future is already written and it's inevitable, but it's also not if we let other people be in power, so we have to make it happen.
That's basically what the purpose of struggle is.
As a result of all of this, Blair worries about the caliber of candidates. Why? I mean, so do we all. Wanting to enter public life today, if you're not careful, there's a real risk that politics becomes a branch of celebrity, he says. So the people coming into politics are the weird and the wealthy. Really? This from a soundbite happy prime minister who brought us a new dawn, the people's princess in the hand of history? Some will roll their eyes at this perma-polished architect of the third way, the man whose embrace of globalization, deregulation, and high immigration arguably contributed to the 2008 financial crisis and even Brexit, returning to evangelize about technology's power to rescue us from our malaise. It is true that New Labour's former frontman has revived some of his favorite old tunes, such as the need for ID cards, announced in 2005, only to be neutered by his own side after he left office and then killed by the Conservatives. But the TBI's contributions during the pandemic, including Blair's personal call for the first doses of COVID vaccines to be given to as many people as possible, quickly adapted by the government, reminded Britain that this was a serious person with the ability to think clearly in a crisis. The chaos of the Johnson administration cast New Labour's cautious managerialism in a kinder light. I actually think that's true, by the way. Mm. I think the Tories have been so bad, and I've made this argument myself on a number of occasions, they have been so bad, so abject, so inept, so fucking useless. You know, that's my why have cotton when you can have silk line. You know, if we're going to be controlled by evil fucks, we might as well have the cautious managerialist competent ones, not these ones, you know.
I disagree with you somewhat there. I think really what's happened is that the permanent bureaucracy of Britain has continued on the Blairite track, but just without Blair.
Yes, no, exactly.
And what you end up doing is, when you look at David Cameron, the history behind that, and you were talking about Unheard. Unheard was set up by the Cameronites. It was set up by the people who created compassionate conservatism. It was created by the people who backed William Hague and David Cameron, all these people. The people who turned, the new Tories into Blairites. It's just the Cameronites. I hopefully people understand what I mean when I say that. But that's what happened, is that Blairite government became the only viable government after he left office. And all of the projects he started, the Equality Act, Slavery Act, the Child Poverty Act, all of these things wrapped the government in massive amounts of red tape, as did the Supreme Court. And there really was only one method to govern Britain. And I think that none of these things do work correctly. I think the idea that there's a brand of ultra-competent managerialism that Blair could head is misguided and wrong-headed, because really what's happening is that this is just the fruition of his plans, and what he wants to happen doesn't work in reality. We have to keep in mind that all of this is him theory crafting, and really he is the architect of things like the Equality Act. He is the architect of Britain's chaos, but he's able to look like he's competent because someone else is always left holding the bag. There's always an excuse. Oh, the other party was in power. Oh, there's this. Oh, there's that. The solutions that Tony Blair posits actually don't work. He is selling you a deeper nightmare and a bigger, more unwieldy machine. But he's able to do so whilst looking competent because of the way that the modern democratic political process works. You're able to go, well, we didn't try hard enough. We didn't have enough people at the helm who were scientific enough. We didn't do this right. We didn't do that right. We didn't lock down hard enough, fast enough. There's always that aspect to it that you have to further the revolution.
Yeah, but would you not agree, though, that compared to the Cameronites and Cameron, who was a fuckwit, let's not forget, New Labour were, you know, okay, their actual solutions don't work, point taken, right? But compared to the Tory government we've had, they look competent. You know, well, I mean, if you were to have a choice between, you know, Blunkett, Prescott, Jack Straw, that whole government, versus like fucking Liz Truss, Cameron, Sunak, you know, all the Patels and Bravermans and so on. Like, these guys have been useless in all ways. I mean, like, I'll give you an example, right? When New Labour said too many asylum seekers are getting in, we're going to create a hostile environment, and we're going to show a graph that shows we've rejected 98% of asylum seekers, and we're going to show a line going down, okay? Now, whether that really happened or not, they were able to create the illusion that it happened. When the Tory government said, we're going to reduce immigration, we're going to sort out the boats, what actually happened was that we got record immigration and record refugees coming over on the small boats, and it's turned into the disaster that we've seen. That, I would say, is the Tories have not been able to show a line on a graph saying, look, here's what we said and here's what we did. Whereas New Labour were pretty good at doing that, even if it was all smoke and mirrors. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I mean, no, I was going to give sort of what I believe to be an example that will come up that speaks to this as well. In that sense, you know, Blair is someone who fundamentally understands how a managerial state, especially in Britain, operates better than any sort of Tory peer, I think you could,
yes,
you could sort of try and compare to him with. And that'll be one of the fundamental reasons why, you know, when Starmer walks in with however many seats and whatever massive majority he has, you might find that overnight tomorrow, the unions that are striking as junior doctors or as railway workers,
yeah,
or as dock workers, because the faction that Tony Blair represents and Starmer sits under is more friendly with these unions because they understand them better and know how to play them better, you will then have this illusion that in the weeks after the Starmer government coming in, the trains start to run on time and things get cheaper in the shops because we've not got these embargoes and blockades at certain ports because dock workers don't want to work. And, oh, you can now get appointments because the junior doctors aren't striking anymore because that good Blair chap's fixed it for us. Even though there's no legal difference to how the system operates or the demands put upon it, merely just by sort of being more friendly and understanding slightly better how unions and these sort of labour constructions work.
They're a better meshing gear.
Yes.
They're a better. What happens is that the Tory party has to at least pretend to stem the tide of progress, but it cannot. So it is simply a gear that ticks a bit and slips. It's like a gear that's removed the wrong way.
But for the sake of their own narrative, they have to be opposed to what the unions want.
Well, there's also,
Labour doesn't. So they can just say they're friendly with them, and then all of a sudden, in the eyes of everyone else, the country looks like it's working again.
There's also the issue that David Cameron, Rishi Sunak, any of those people, Priti Patel, were never actually in charge. The idea that they were governing this country in a real sense, in a power sense, is laughable. They were always at the whims of the departments, and every government is always at the whims of the permanent bureaucracy, who is the real power center in control. They are the people who interpret the laws, they implement the frontline services, they stamp the visas, they quite literally have their hands on all of the pieces of what makes the UK government function. So I think what happens is that Blair and his lot are in control of those people via the NGOs, via global governance, via all of the media that these people consume. They are the acolytes of the normal, neutral, liberal position. Many of them might even consider themselves further along than that. To them, someone like Tony Blair is almost a conservative. So when you get someone like a Tony Blair or a Keir Starmer that comes into power, what happens is suddenly they all agree. Suddenly there's no dispute with the permanent bureaucracy anymore, and the nightmare moves smoother. But it's whether you want a smoother transition into a nightmare world or a slightly more juddery transition to a nightmare world. The end point is the same, and many of the pitfalls along the way from the failed policies will also be the same. I think the idea that governance would have been different in any way materially under Blair is wrong, because governance is done by the permanent bureaucracy. It's never done by the politicians. The outcomes would have been almost identical.
I think you misplace how important narratives and narratives specifically related to individuals are in this sense. But we'll move on, because otherwise we could sit and blether about this for the next hour.
I will make 2 points here. First is that my understanding is that the Blair government had a lot of enforcers on the ground, essentially, to bully departments into submission. That was one thing that Blair's government was noted for. Now, when the Tories try those same tactics, because don't forget, they all hero worship Blair, so they try to do the same stuff. But when the Tories try to do it, you get headlines like, oh, Priti Patel's bullying and all this sort of stuff. Whereas when it was Blair's government, they got away with it. It'll be interesting to see whether Keir Starmer, when he's in power, will be able to get away with stuff that in kind of today's quote unquote woke environment would be seen as bullying. Given what they've done within Labour already, and given how they're just destroying people like Angela Rayner in real time, I would suggest they will get away with it.
People will welcome it. Again, when it's meshing with the rest of the machine, when the actual power brokers give it a thumbs up, it's all permissible. It's all about making it all move in the same direction. But I think the idea that it's better governance, in quotes, is a bit of an illusion. It's just a smoother transition to where the liberal consensus wants to move to.
The other thing I just want to mention really quickly on the distinction, my view on the distinction, you guys may disagree, between the Cameronites or the twats who run the Tory party and the Blairites, is that I believe there's a degree of cynicism, Machiavellianism in the Blairite contingent that is somewhat missing in the Cameronistas, right? So when David Cameron says, my proudest achievement was introducing gay marriage, right? Or when Liz Truss becomes the prime minister and tries to enact her fucking IEA penned economic plan, right? These people are like true believers in those doctrines, whereas regardless of what he says out loud, I have no doubt that Blair just doesn't really believe in, you know, the power of the market, quote unquote. You know, he has already ingested and imbibed all of the kind of anti-liberal critiques from people like John Gray and so on. So in his view, when he talks about free markets, it's always a fully managed market and this almost kind of state and corporation working hand in hand. He doesn't actually mean, you know, let's try to enact Mises or something. Whereas I think some of the Tories who come from the IEA come into government genuinely believing some of these kind of liberal priors. So in that way, this is kind of counterintuitive, but I think the Tories are actually more ideological than New Labour.
Far more. Yes. They are the ideology cells compared to the sort of Chad Blairite realists.
Well, they're a sad photocopy of Blairites. That's all they're allowed to be. And as such, yes, they are inferior, but again, shall we continue with the article though?
Yeah, let's carry on. In 2003, I just don't want zero seats to be eroded in any way by the fact that the other side are in fact bad and evil as well. In 2003, a young barrister named Keir Starmer wrote an article warning the Prime Minister that invading in breach of international law would be a precarious business. In his biography of the Labour leadership, the journalist Tom Baldwin writes that Sir Keir, who was knighted in 2014, initially kept his distance from his divisive predecessor and associates such as Lord Mandelson. the momentum wing of the Labour Party, after all, hates Blair with an internecine ferocity the Tories could never quite match. Before he, but you see, that is return. I've always said that that is returned in spades by the new Labour lot, who hate them equally. Before he ran for the leadership after Labour's crushing 2019 election defeat, Starmer was shadow Brexit secretary to the momentum-backed Jeremy Corbyn. Observers point out that Starmer has since made an ascent of man journey across the political spectrum, from winning the Labour leadership on a Corbyn-like ticket to engaging Brown for a review of constitutional reform to getting cosy with Blair. Starmer sceptics see this as evidence of his ability to use people and then drop them. Others see it as proof of Blair's enduring magnetism. Perhaps it is a bit of both. It is now widely acknowledged that alongside the centre-left campaign group Labour Together and the left-leaning Resolution Foundation think tank, the TBI is likely to be an influential voice under the Labour government. Starmer, who shared a stage with Blair at the TBI's Future of Britain conference last summer, has populated his team with Blairites, including the former Blair special advisor Matthew Doyle, now Starmer's director of communications, the former Blair strategist and speechwriter Peter Hyman, who is now a senior advisor, and another former Blair special advisor Peter Kyle, who now is now the shadow science secretary. In particular, Kyle and Wes Streeting, the glossy shadow health secretary, are said to act as Blair's emissaries around the shadow cabinet table. Mariana McFadden, previously the head of Insight at the TBI, is deputy to Starmer's campaign director, Morgan McSweeney. Working with them is Mariana's husband, Pat McFadden, a Blair government veteran who is Labour's election campaign chief. He says one of the good things that Keir has done is to tell the Labour Party and the country that he's really proud of what Labour's done in government. We went through a period of time after 2010 when we weren't telling the Labour Party and the country that. And that's a welcome change. Here's
can we,
a picture.
Can we get a zoom in on that image, please?
Yeah.
Can we get a quick zoom in, enhance?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure Tony Blair's wearing headwear of some variety there, but I can't quite work out what it is. Oh, yeah. There we go.
Well, that is because it's a sign of respect. I read into the wearing of the kippah, and apparently it's a sign of respect at kind of things like funerals or visiting the wall and things like that. And for a long time, leaders did not wear they'd avoid visiting the wall and wear it and being seen wearing the kippah, and that changed sometime in the 90s, and now they do it kind of almost automatically when they go over there. So there we are.
I see that chat's items have begun bouncing.
Yes, yeah, so smoke me a kippah. I'll be back for Shavuot.
McFadden describes the TBI as a useful resource for different members of the shadow cabinet. Curiosity is an essential function of leadership, and people who want to occupy positions of government responsibility have a duty to be curious about technological change, he says. In an era of tight money, there's so much of the debate is around fiscal events and headroom. You need a broader debate. I'm not saying that public services don't need investment. Of course they do. But there is also going to be interest in how services can be reformed and whether technology can help you get greater productivity, a.k.a. how can we strip the guts out of the NHS and everything else and streamline it down to automated AI services run by one of Blair's friends in a private-public partnership, because that is what they're going to do. With a deeply unpopular Conservative government almost visibly falling apart, and Labour surfing double-digit polls, strains of D-Reams, things can only get better, are once again in the air. But Starmer and Rachel Reeves, the Shadow Chancellor, lack Blair and Brown's wattage. Is that a way of saying that they're low IQ, or that they've not got
the energy?
They've not got the pizzazz. I think they're right, though, in that really Blair is from a political generation that is recognizable, and everyone else after him is not. I reckon that most people, before he came back as Foreign Secretary, will have kind of forgotten that David Cameron existed.
Mm.
Everybody since Blair, and a lot of people, you know, people don't remember John Major. In people's heads, it goes, Winston Churchill, Thatcher, Tony Blair, and that's people's record. Yeah, yeah. Boris, maybe? That's people's recognition of the UK Prime Minister. And he's really one of the only living political figures who still compass mentis, who most British people, even if they don't respect, would at least recognize as somebody who like is an authority and has wielded power in some way, a recognizably wielded power. I think that's his real superpower, is that he is one of the few people that the British population of kind of a 30 to about 60 believes is powerful.
Well, yeah, I mean, can we think of any Western leader in the last 3 or 4 decades that has managed to maintain 2.5 decades of constant influence over national and international politics? I might say briefly as well, I'm going to use my intense influence. Someone fetch Maven and make sure we're doing a D Reams Things Can Only Get Better karaoke for this year's Shieldings.
I would just like to mention that, have you ever listened to Rachel Reeves talk? She is so boring. She's so dull. It's unreal how dull she is. She makes Gordon Brown seem like he's charismatic. Although I will say she's pizzazzing up her image. There she is in a fetching red number. Ooh.
Ooh, get pizzazzed.
Now I will say...
All the woods and chat.
Now, I would say that Blair did always keep around these uber boring managerial women who seem like who seem kind of dry and cobwebbed, if you know what I mean.
Klaus Schwab does the same.
Claire Short and who else was in that cabinet? Oh, Ruth Kelly. You know, there was always a plethora of uber boring managerial women around.
Ruth Kelly.
There were big personalities as well in that cabinet, as well as Blair. Everybody will think of Prescott, but you know,
big bunches Prescott, yeah.
You know, but you know, like Mandelson was a personality, and
Campbell,
and you know, the whole crew really. Charles Clark was a bruiser. You know, I got a whole stream going through them, and I feel like Starmer's cabinet is made up of more of that kind of quiet managerial type, and it really does lack a bit of that pizzazz. And ironically, they're getting rid of the only person who does have any personality, which is Angela Rayner, who's got a lot of dinner lady kind of school dinners. You know, she'll make you a Bovril, basically.
Part of me does wonder if that sort of class of people like Angela Rayner that are kept about. I mean, Angela Rayner must be one of the most unpopular people on the planet.
Yes.
I can't really speak any great words of criticism about her because it might be illegal. But I bet you one element why these people stay is probably because they're filthy in the sheets. Managerial in the streets, filthy in the sheets.
I gotta say, she does look like somebody who was like disgraced for having an office affair or something.
And give you a serious gobble.
she does have big disabled toilets energy, yes.
I just want to mention, by the way, that Angela Rayner is on the left of the Labour Party, and I couldn't help but notice that she took a lot of digs at Blair a couple of years back, and now she's under police investigation. It's funny how that happens, isn't it?
What's happening to Nicola Sturgeon these days?
Yeah. Who must go? It's going to be Assad and Blair, and that's it.
Yeah.
It's going to be two world leaders. But I think your point to the boring functionaries that he has on staff, though, is I think that the Starmer government is going to be deliberately boring. It's going to be the most boring boilerplate government you've ever witnessed. It will have a massive mandate and it will pretend to do basically nothing with it whilst actually completely reforming how Britain works on paper, if the new Britain document is anything to go by. But I believe the flashy stuff will come from supranational government deliberately. We'll have a non-government here and we'll be looking to the Blairs, if he's still alive, the Schwabs and all of this stuff. We'll be looking to global events, not national events, because things will stop happening, as it were, even more so in Britain. Things will just fall into kind of... If you remember how stupid people were kind of 1997 to about 2001, people just went to sleep. And that's what kind of Keir Starmer's first term will be like. People will go to sleep because it will not be the pandemic anymore. There'll not be as much. I think a lot of the geopolitics stuff is starting to move back from a little bit. And it's going to be death by boringness. It's going to be the classic tactic of managerialism, which is making the horrible things they're doing beneath the surface so boring from an out perspective that no one will care or even look at it.
Yeah. Oh, boy, you think nothing's happening now. Wait till you see how much nothing's going to happen soon.
Yeah.
Blair credits Starmer with yanking the party ruthlessly back into the mainstream. There would have been a split in Labour if he hadn't, he says. But in the end, it would have become clear that you just couldn't win with what you had. I mean, I love to say there was a split in Labour.
Yeah.
I love the way he always tried to frame things as neutral. There was a split in Labour and you just purged the shit out of them and kicked them out of the party.
I still think that's one of the most unapologetically based thing that's happened in like British politics for decades. That is that they've basically cooed all of the useful leftist radicals out of the Labour Party and disciplined it as an entire organisation.
And you know what happened? Everybody cheered.
Yeah. Oh, of course.
It's a great example that you're not supposed to like woke people. It's a real hat tip. It's a real sort of hands tip. Is kind of Corbyn and the fate of the Corbynites, that you are deliberately not supposed to like these people, and that the entire industry of anti-woke is a massive regime project.
You see, I thought the clue was that accounts with hundreds of millions of followers retweet libs of TikTok, but that's just me, you know. Okay, but does Starmer have ideas? The response is lukewarm. I think he's got ideas. The challenge for Labour is going to be how it inherits a situation that is economically very difficult and then makes change against that background. Blair's prescriptions are, unsurprisingly, technocratic. For example, the TBI has called for faster building of key infrastructure, claiming that since the national policy statements governing big energy projects were updated in 2012, the average time it takes to obtain planning consent has gone up by 65%. The problem with progressive politics is that very often that the radical people aren't sensible and the sensible people aren't radical.
Oh, I love that line. That's so great.
We have to put that.
Me too, Tone. Me too.
I'm going to tweet that out. I'm going to tweet that out. That's amazing.
Can you tweet it out but pretend it's like a Lenin quote or something? or maybe even Hitler. That would maybe even be funnier.
You put people in the situation where they're either enthusiastic and misguided, or they're lacking enthusiasm, but then rather boring. You've got to define radical politics as not about spending money. The truth is, if you want to meet net zero, the single biggest thing you can do is reform a planning system that is utterly ridiculous. It can take years. Even if you build a renewable power plant, it can get onto the national grid. These are things that Labour should and can grapple with. So what he's saying is that you should be, we need a sort of person who's going to get excited by this stat here. Oh, we need to reduce planning consent from 65% back down to 20%. You know, and this is where you might be talking about boring people to sleep here. It takes a very special person to get excited about that. There is also Britain's relationship with Europe. It would be wise to reset it, Blair says. There's too many things that affect us that are going on in Europe. That doesn't mean to say that Starmer will start trying to frame this as rejoining the EU or even the single market. In any event, we've got a trade negotiation coming up in 2025. But at the moment, we're going outside the big political union on our own continent, and we've got a disrupted trading relationship with our biggest trading partner. So you've got to fix this stuff. To be fair to Rishi Sunak, he's trying to fix as much as he can, given the constraints he's under from his own party.
Yeah, as someone whose opinion on Brexit has changed somewhat in the last couple of years, I think that's going to stick for a lot of people. There's a lot of small business people in Britain who could basically be given a pat on the back and told, look, vote Labour, we'll fix the trade deal with the EU and whatever stuff you're important is going to be here. in days, not weeks, and it'll cost you pounds, not a fortune.
It's the big thing that they deliberately broke a system over and above what it needed to be. This is deliberate pain. There's been deliberate pain to make this trajectory happen. I don't think it'll happen during the first Labour government. There's probably going to inevitably be a second one. But the thing is, they don't even have to reverse Brexit. All they need to do is do a rising tide of small deals that adds up to what it was anyway. And then they'll come round in, say, 5 years or maybe even 10 years and just say, well,
we're basically back in now anyway.
Yeah, we've had to fix all these issues that the business people asked us to fix. We've had to basically rejoin the EU in everything but name. Why don't we just rejoin it in name as well, so we have a seat at the table? That's the trajectory here. I think Tony Blair is just exasperated by a lot of people's inability to, one, be boring, and two, to boil the frog. That really all that needs to happen is things continue on the track. Don't mess up. Don't do these big flashy things. I think he's probably very annoyed with the way the Americans are. He does, like I said, the whole radical, sensible thing there. He sounds exasperated. He sounds like he just wants to get on with the business of governance, which I think is the tone he was going for. But he's probably who he is and why he's so successful. I think he just wants to get things done in a world where those people really just don't exist anymore in governance. What he wants to get done is horrible in many cases, but at least he wants to get it done. At least he's willing to put the legwork in to do it, which is why he gets where he gets.
Yeah, he's basically said as much already when it comes to the Democrats in America. He's been very critical of them, and he even called Biden an imbecile at one point. But he's, when it comes to America, he always tries to be diplomatic and not kind of keep out of it, quote unquote, mainly so he doesn't alienate anybody, I suppose. Blair at 70 looks like his younger, like his photogenic younger self put through an Instagram aging filter. The eyes are still earnest blue. Spitting image grin still framed by the distinctive ears. He is trim, albeit touched by a slight stiffness, but the mane has long since grayed. Chelsea boots add a louche touch he wouldn't have got away with in the days of being tough on crime and its causes. So when we talked about puff pieces, that paragraph there is just,
that's a puff daddy, that is. So that's a lot of...
If I was his editor, I'd be what's that paragraph doing there? Just kind of, okay.
You got to humanize him.
But by the way, one of my pet hates is interviews like this, where it's a mixture of prose and interview.
I don't even think this is an interview.
No, some of these comments are from years prior. This is why we said the fact that we feel it's like a... some sort of package the TBI has put together to advertise itself. Because you notice there's criticism in here, but it's the sort of criticism Blair would place upon himself.
To defuse it.
Yeah, yes. To defuse it as part of his own larger frame.
The former Prime Minister still crisscrosses the globe. San Francisco one day, Guana the next. Someone in his extended circle says, I wonder who that is, the gossip among the security people who look after former prime ministers is that you work for John Major and one day at the cricket is quite fun, but do we have to go every day for 5 days? You work for Theresa May and you have a pretty quiet life. You work for Tony Blair and you're bound to get divorced because you're on the road 250 days a year, stepping in and out of a private jet every 2 days. It's great fun, but your marriage doesn't last. So there's that.
As a quick aside, somebody's actually mentioned a semi-interesting thing in chat there. How much does Blair have left in him? Then they go on to talk about Kissinger being a bit tragic in his final years. I think that's one thing we can guarantee we won't see is old, decrepit Blair staggering around like Biden. I think they will do whatever they can to make sure there is not the slightest bit of footage that shows him as disorganized or bumbling or
no,
until he's basically just about to die, there will not be a snippet of that.
No, this is all so tight to control. He's advertised like a man in his 50s.
I've also noticed, by the way, that he very tightly limits who gets to speak to him, who doesn't. He never takes any questions from the public. He's very shielded in that way, in a way that is There's one thing that they always did well. It was the PR stuff, wasn't it? Blair still receives the digital equivalent of the prime ministerial box he used to get before heading from number 10 to Chequers for the weekend. The TBI staff send him a whole stack of reports, what we're doing in Africa, what we're doing in Asia. Why expend all this energy when he could be following Major or May's examples and adjusting his work-life balance? If you've had the get up and go to go into politics and then you become prime minister for 10 years, it's frankly unlikely that when you finish, you'll just want to sit back, Blair says. People always want to ascribe some sort of malign, or let's say benign, but psychological motive to it. I came into politics because I wanted to make a difference, and I still want to. Now I can do it in a different way. Okay. There is a sense of unfinished business, though. In 2009, he tried to and failed to become the first president of the European Council, a platform he says he would have used to try to put Europe on a path to reform. A close friend says it took Blair years after leaving Parliament to accept that he would never return to a frontline role in British politics. He often remarks wistfully that he knew the least about how to get things done when he was at the peak of his popularity in the 1990s, at the most just at the point when he was forced out. In 1999, he complained about the lack of scars on my back after 2 years, about the scars on my back after 2 years of trying to modernise public services, prompting a row with the unions. He doubled down at the Labour conference that September, attacking the forces of conservatism, small c, that he said were holding back progress. Blair's autobiography, A Journey, or My Bookie Work, or My Struggle, details how Brown's resistance to reforms, such as introducing more patient choice into the NHS, which he apparently dubbed marketisation, morphed into an enervating and depressing struggle over ID cards. Badly wounded by Iraq, Blair eventually lost his long arm wrestle with Brown over the leadership and resigned in 2007 to a standing ovation from the Commons, but chuntering from many on his own benches. He then had to watch from the sidelines as, in his view, his political partner of more than two decades ditched their modernising project and reverted to old Labour. Okay. I don't know if we'll read on and on. Are there any bits, because we're running out of time, that you guys want to zoom in on? It's quite a long one.
There's a part particularly towards the end where he discusses democracy and essentially says something to the effect of, well, technology is going to change the political environment so much that democracy is not going to really work, because at the end of the day, democracy is just what people want, but what people want can't always be provided to them. So we'll decide for them.
Yeah, so I think it's this bit. Blair remarks that Sunak is the fifth prime minister in 8 years. And surprisingly enough, we've got a lot of problems. He says democracy is ultimately what people want, because the problem with countries that aren't democracies is they're fine if you happen to have really smart people running them. But if you don't, there's a problem. Democracy can deliver, but it's a problem today because it is an old fashioned politics trying to deal with a very new fashioned world, he says. That's why the right is defaulting to nationalistic policies, which are just a dead end. And the left is struggling. One part of it has gone for identity politics, which is another cul-de-sac. What have the two things got in common? They're both victim ideologies. You never build anything from victimhood.
See, he uses the phrase victimhood there. I believe he's talking about consensus. I think he's fully hearkening onto something there, that we should be relying on principles of social and political organization that the machines tell us to do, or what the machines dictate would be the best thing to do. That listening to the people is going to get in the way of the progress that the machines might provide us.
There's a lot being said there. Something we picked up on, again, years ago, is the fact that if you look at something like the Nudge Unit that you've spoken about before, the Behavioural Insights team, with inside kind of David Cameron's number 10, that was Blairism distilled. It was this idea of the power of government, and especially the power of, like, open shirt, kind of slightly modern management government, that they could create these, what they referred to as choice environments, and really through technocratic language and through managerial language, work around what they see as the inconvenience of democracy. And what's going to happen, and what I think Donald Trump's role will be in America, is that the right, in quotes, will be the ones saddled with the millstone of democracy. And the Blairs of this world will simply transcend it and say, look, it's old fashioned. We have technology that can do this now. It's slow. It doesn't work. And just admit reality. The problem with these people is at any moment, they can admit a section of reality and it completely undercuts any effort to dislodge them, because them admitting something that is clearly true doesn't really do anything. And it's a very clever move here to de-emphasize democracy, because democracy will be, in many senses, put away over the next two decades. We will still have it, you know, as a principle, and it will ironically be wheeled out more and more as a something to react against. It has been in, you know, 2020 onwards. But really what's happening is, if you look at the inter-elite communication, if you look at the Nudge Unit, if you look at the policy papers, if you look at what politicians are saying, who actually make decisions, who are actually will to power men like Tony Blair is, they are not talking about democracy. They are talking in very kind of spitting terms about populism. And that, again, is something that people need to watch out for. There's going to be this huge push, I think, for the right, in quotes, to save old-fashioned democracy, to save old-fashioned civic society, to save essentially the liberal democratic dream, when really our managers and our rulers have abandoned it because it is unworkable. And that is the dynamic I see moving forward.
Yeah, I mean, I foresee that they have a big problem on their hands if they push ahead with some of the green stuff in the next couple of years. That is going to be the traumatic battle, I think.
To walk some of that back. Hollywood's turned around and said they're getting rid of all their net zero standards, and they're going to rewrite them so they can basically write it in a way that they don't really have to do anything, but they say they've succeeded anyway. I would wonder, shall we get to the couple of paragraphs right at the bottom after the last sort of portrait? I think gets to two issues that relate to something, or the things that we sort of have been talking about quite a lot recently. Because I believe he basically said he has two questions that he won't really address. One, what is his standing with either Trump or Biden? And two, what is his opinion on what's currently happening in Israel? Which is an interesting one, because I know you have spent quite a lot of time considering the possibility that certain factions want rid of Netanyahu. Now, yes. If I've read this article correctly and I've understood other things I've seen before me correctly, Blair stands out as one of the few Western leaders who, it was at one point, felt powerful enough within himself to stop selling arms to Israel and sort of at least narratively threaten Netanyahu. Does him coming back into the fold of more public politics suggest that Blair and whoever he's up with are maybe not against Zionism, but whatever Netanyahu style of Zionism stands for, that's something they may be opposed to?
Yeah, the Likud faction, which is known. Yes. I think that... And I do think that Blair keeping shtum about this is basically not supporting Netanyahu, you know, because this is one thing that you can always tell, that if he's for something, he'll be effusive about it. And if he's not, he'll be more diplomatic.
It's truth by omission.
So, yeah, I mean, I don't think the British establishment in general is that Israel friendly, which sounds ridiculous given what's happened, but they do it almost as a kind of, how can I put it? They do it because they have to, because Washington expects them to, but they're always snide and grudging about it. Even Cameron has been a bit like that since he's been the foreign secretary. And I think that he privately probably is not up for what they're doing over there. And also, he has worked with Trump before. And
well, this is
been critical of Biden. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's something I've considered is that I could see sort of Blair using some of his final competent years in the public limelight, essentially palling around with people like Trump, maybe even like Farage. I mean, Farage spent quite a long period during lockdown essentially singing Blair's praises.
Yes, he did.
And essentially putting his hands up and saying, well, I don't want Boris Johnson because he's going to mess up lockdown. I want Tony Blair because he'll do it right. I can sort of see a faction of the right that is more quote-unquote futurist, that's more progressive. The way we're told to think about Malay and this Bukele guy in El Salvador, I could see these kind of people all getting very friendly with Tony Blair.
I could also just see them do it. I mean, think about Tony Blair's special relationship with George W. Bush.
Yes.
Who really is, I hate to say it, but Trump is a Bush figure. If you look at George W. Bush in 2001, he's the supposedly dumb, down-home conservative who's saying all the stuff the other conservative politicians won't say, and is defending the populist ideals of the American public and the American right and all this. It's very similar, and quite honestly, I could see them trying to, at least in a limited sense, have Starmer be buddy-buddy with Trump if he gets in. There's no reason for them to be adversarial. I mean, the left of the Labour Party...
He's going to have to be, because he's the United States president and it's a British prime minister, so they have to work a settlement, yeah.
But everyone's kind of been embarrassed. Nobody is visibly trying to be buddy-buddy with Biden because Biden's radioactive.
No.
It's really funny seeing the international stage, as it were, because everybody treats Biden like he's just shit himself, because he probably has. But it's amazing that really America's kind of at the heights of its flailing around, getting towards what looks like very late stage empire, but they still have very good hegemony. He's technically on paper a very, very powerful person. And yet he's so awful that nobody really wants to go near him. Nobody really is his, like, who is his friend internationally? Nobody, really. He's not got any famous positive relationships. I mean, look at the bromance between Trump and Kim Jong-un. I mean, it was kind of a meme, but there was something of like a rapport there. It at least looked like they had an interesting time talking to each other. And that's why I think they're going to cycle out Biden. Biden's such a, like a, he's like a farting disaster. He is actually just an embarrassing old person that everybody tries not to look at.
The whole administration has been an embarrassment. Not just him, Blinken, that Austin, you know, the black dude, Kamala. I mean, it's just like it will probably go down in history as one of the worst presidencies of all time. Period.
Popular man in American electoral history.
I couldn't help but notice, by the way, that in the bit we skipped over, one of our long-term calls, I mean, I think we were talking about this back in like 2020 or 2019 even, that Blair will use the ID cards as an anti-immigration yes. argument. And I mean,
that's also got the Nick Clegg bit in there as well, which is semi-funny. I mean, I have to admit, I have taken upon the position that I am already accepted that the public at large, due to the way that the consensus manufacturing machine works, will just, the moment they go digital ID to bring the immigration numbers down to a sensible 500,000 a year, they will just vote for it. I mean, it's so, I don't even know how this is the word. We are inundated with such intense digital ID propaganda. We are given so many different policies and solutions for other problems in society that demand a digital ID sort of infrastructure, that it might as well already be there. I mean, I think that's one of the greatest tricks Blair and his ilk pull off, is by pretending that these systems don't exist whilst they build them, so that by the time they've built them, they can turn around and go, well, actually, we've had this for years, and here it is, and it works, and you all use it now. It sort of just completely blows people off their feet, really, even though they've been told to expect it all that time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I noticed they've done this with the contact, you know, the cashless society thing. where it's like, well, suddenly loads of places don't have cash anymore, and you just tap. You're just used to tapping to pay for stuff. Well, we're doing it anyway. You know what I mean? Yeah, like, no. Kind of, and they'll make a digital ID a bit like this. So it's almost seamless. You're doing all the stuff already.
You know? It's called altering the choice environment.
Yes, exactly.
I would encourage you, I think I sent it to you in that. I would encourage you to read that kind of nudge unit document thing. You might have read it before, but it's very clear, I think, from that especially. They even talk about what you talk about. They actually talk about culture being downstream from law. It's bizarre to see that in a government document, but it's true. But I think really there is this abandonment of the will of the mass, as it were, as a guiding principle. There is this idea that human mass makes bad decisions and therefore we need closer management. And it's really a good indicator that liberal democracy, in quotes, was merely an intermediary stage. It was almost like a pupating stage of whatever this global governance will be. But again, whatever grand proclamations they make, they can't really fight entropy. And our vision has always been that all of this is theory crafting. And in reality, all they ever do is make things worse.
Yeah, well, we've got about 10 minutes, 15 minutes for Super Chats before Cigar Stream starts. I've got Charlie coming on with an interesting take. He is arguing against the notion that nothing ever happens and actually says that this is a subversive meme that everybody should drop. So I'm kind of interested to discuss that further. That will be directly following this show. But there have been some super chats. C123 says, seeing another round of counter jihad be subtly effective with many right-wing and DR posters of late, lots of people buying into the white plus J versus brown / PS framing. Well, yes, C123. When I explained to you that the vast majority of people, including people sitting and watching this stream, are fucking idiots, I mean it.
Yeah, no, I'd agree with that. I watched them revive Imam Tawhidi the other day on my Twitter feed, and it just goes to, you know, the same. Look at the way Tommy Robinson came back.
Oh,
we
yeah.
We all
knew was involved in that. Yeah. Anyway.
We all knew he was a Zionist. We all knew he basically pallied up with a bunch of Mossad people because they used to run security as free speech events. And then he gets released back onto Twitter with Katie Hopkins. And in a matter of a week, they've organized an event at the Cenotaph where hundreds of people get arrested. And then you still have people running around on Twitter pretending that Tommy Robinson is some sort of legitimate representative of British dissident ideas in the same way that fucking Constant Kissing is.
I mean, we call their plays in real time. We watch them work in real time. And we're also called bastards for it, or called names for it as well. Nothing ever changes. Coney
Nothing
says...
Nothing ever happens.
we'll discuss that next. Coney says, is the purpose of British life making enough money to avoid the consequences of New Labour's political legacy? I don't think money's going to get you out of it. I don't know if British life has a purpose, being stuck in traffic forever. 2 minutes Hate says, I heard he's in line to take over the WEF. That has been rumoured for quite a while. The thing is, I mean, my question is, what is the value of taking over the quote unquote WEF? Does Tone want to run a conference in Davos every year, or what does the WEF do that the TBI doesn't already do, would be my question.
I think it would just be, I think the WEF is kind of a formalized business grouping. It would really just allow it to fully switch its allegiance. I don't even think it would still exist in the same way. Are you right? I think the WEF is actually slightly outmoded.
Yes.
In many ways. It's kind of yesteryears. It's the supranational organization of 10 years ago.
I mean, who does the WEF have in their phone book that Tone doesn't have in his?
Yeah. Nobody.
Yeah.
I think what it would be is just a subsummation of the formalized kind of business gatherings into, you know, a centralized core. And he can make a very compelling argument like, look, we are the franchise. We are the big tent. We are the market leader. Align with us, you'll have an easy time. You'll have a good time. Everyone will eat. And that again, it's their argument. It's a very, if you're up there on the mountain, it's a very seductive argument.
I'll never forget when they put on that conference to discuss what they should be discussing at the WEF 2 weeks before the WEF happened. Do you remember that? It's like, oh, what are we going to tell the leaders in a couple of months? Maybe him controlling it will simply eliminate the need for that conference, that pre-WEF conference that they hold. Spastica Autistica says, Tony Blair, the David Bowie of British politics. I don't know about that, because Bowie changed his image every couple of years, whereas Blair has very much just always been the same, never updating his kind of basic playbook or style. He's more like kind of the Rolling Stones or something.
He's moved his more of a production role. I think he's the Dr. Dre of British politics. And he had a frontline career, and then he was the man behind the men for a very long... He definitely is the Dr. Dre.
So New Labour was NWA, TBI is Beats by Dre.
No. It's NWA through the Chronic and 2001, and then he goes into kind of, discovers Eminem and all that. He's Dr. Dre.
This is getting so bizarre. So like David Cameron is Eminem, and Keir Starmer's 50 Cent and all these kind of lamented guide says, been watching you for a while, first time catching you live. Cheers. Well, thank you very much, lamented guide. It means so much. Louis
Shaw as well. Thanks, lamented guide.
Louis Shaw Moffat says, things do happen. The cycle of might makes right is returning. We simply put up with the momentum of nothing ever happens for now. He also says, I do think Israel will be the test case of that claim of might makes right returning. I am skeptical about the chances of Israeli success in the coming years, to put it mildly. Maybe I watched too much Judge Knapp. Time will tell, but I feel like the Schmittian exception will be removed from Israel in the coming years. And in fact, tone silence on that question spoke volumes, because that's usually a good guide of general regime thinking on these things.
It's interesting, isn't it? We're now surrounding with people who are just like, not in the way that, well, yes, in the way that we do, that who love the nation of Israel.
Oh, my love for the nation of Israel is undying.
but it seems that the love of the nation of Israel isn't so undying for someone like Tony Blair.
No,
which is a bit of an odd observation, isn't it?
It doesn't carry that sort of strap me to a rocket and fire me at Tehran sort of energy that we carry.
No, he doesn't.
It's interesting, though, because he's still got that special advisor role at the ADL. I wonder what he advises them. I wonder what he says to them. In fact, I've never really seen Blair talk about anti-Semitism even once. He must be the worst ADL advocate of all time.
No, I know what he's telling the ADL every time they ask for his help. He just turns around and goes, nothing ever happens.
Louis, sack Jonathan Greenblatt if you know what's good for you.
Oh, I.
He probably has told him that, to be fair.
Louis Shawmore, get rid of the woke shit. Louis Shawmorefit says, undersea cables are maintained by a rapidly aging group of engineers. Morgoth did a piece on this last year. Also fisted by Foucault did a piece recently.
Everything is maintained by rapidly aging British engineers. Everything in the world. Not undersea cables. It's everything. It's incredibly terrifying from my perspective, because I'm in the construction industry nominally. But entire sectors of engineering globally are literally going to die out in the next 10 years. The expertise will be lost in like a Bronze Age collapse sense. It is as alarmist as certain people are being about the skills collapse stuff, it is even worse than people are saying. It is one of the biggest time bombs, is the loss of human skill in the West, because it's the only place it exists. It doesn't exist outside the West. This level of inherent engineering knowledge is not something you can learn from a textbook. It's not something you can learn from the internet. I know this firsthand from having gone through the process of becoming a, you know, a technical specialist engineer over many years, you have to learn it from people. And if those people die before they're passing your knowledge, you lose it. And you lose the ability to maintain the complex systems of the world. So, yes, I think that's it's that. But imagine that everywhere. And that is the situation. And I can safely say that I do know it is the situation. I don't like knowing that.
I'll just point out again, Hammersmith Bridge closed since 2019.
Yes.
There's nobody who wants to fix it or can fix it. So there we are. All right. I think that. Oh, Benjamin Rood has come in and said, best stream for a while. Cheers. I hope for a while you mean like 4 days, which was the last time I had a stream. You know, if somebody says that every single stream. This is the best stream for a while. Best stream in ages. Every single stream. There'll be somebody who says that. I never know.
Every stream is somebody's favorite.
Every stream is somebody's favorite. Apart from, I'm trying to think of a stream that was nobody's favorite.
The Filthy Frank one.
That one. There'll be some strange individuals who like that stream.
That's I've seen those ones. Those aren't people. That was my point.
Okay. All right. And I think that is pretty much it. I'll just remind. Oh, Sam153 just says simple. Cheers. Well, thank you very much, Sam153. It means so much. Do you know, for a long time, I had an unwritten rule that I would only say it means so much in response to Sam153, but I have recently relaxed that, deep lore fans. So there we are.
You must be softening in your old age. Won't it see you in September and sort you out?
Anything you guys would like to promote before we get out of here?
Well, I'll do our spiel again. You can watch our stuff over at the Scrump Monkey YouTube channel. We also run the Anti-Politics Substack.
Yes.
And we have various communication platforms like Telegram and so forth. But you can generally find those from those two platforms. I have possibly a couple of guest videos and other people's channels coming out at some point, but they're in limbo due to me being busy.
Yes.
having a real job. So.
And if people are looking for something to do before they watch UO tomorrow, our mutual friend, Mr. Panama Hat, will be joining us to talk about the recent sort of smoking ban and a general discussion of smoking, because it's great.
Yes. Smoking is base. The more them smoke, the more based you are.
Yes.
I have become obsessed with smoking cigars recently. I don't know if you noticed that, but it's because there was a let up in the incessant bloody rain in this country. And
it's been nice for you.
I've gone, well, it's still raining up in wherever you guys are.
Yeah. I've taken to special measures of layering up on a Friday or a Sunday evening so I can enjoy a cigar at the back of my local drinkery.
I now have a giant umbrella, of course, which means I even had a cigar in the hail the other day. You haven't lived until you've had a cigar in the hail. Anyway, I actually recorded footage yesterday on how to taste a cigar. I was going to put out a short. I just didn't get round to it. I'm now debating as to whether I should do it at all. So people vote in the chat if you'd like that it'll probably be like a 1 minute short on how to taste a cigar and how to retrohale, which is where the smoke comes out of your nose. Anyway, I will be back in a minute with Charlemagne talking about the Nothing Ever Happens meme. Still a few of those promo code mellow coupons left. They all must go. Sale stops tonight. Thank you very much, you two.
Thanks for having us on. Hopefully see you again some point soon.
Yes, see you again.
What's going on in this town is no human.
As long as I'm living here, it is.
Well, maybe you should have been living here!
Well, that's easily fixed.